of economics that seeks to reduce poverty by ensuring that policy is informed by scientific evidence. James started his work with J-PAL as a research manager working on knowledge management and data quality assurance, and today he leads J-PAL's work on research transparency. This includes managing and developing the American Economics Association's registry for randomized controlled trials, organizing J-PAL's data security, curation, and publication services, and developing new processes for conducting replications in the social sciences. He's here today to speak about the reproducibility crisis. Please welcome James Torito.
Great. Thank you very much. Are we facing a reproducibility crisis today? I think that that's a critically important question. And first, I want to, before I get into this question, I want to thank you for inviting me to come here and talk about this issue. This is my first time really getting involved with the EA community and getting to meet people. The issues that I'm going to talk about is a little bit different than the previous talk with regards to nuclear war and AI. We're going to talk about some of the things that William actually brought up this morning in terms of what the purpose of the EA community does and what it serves. It's not just a philanthropic community and way to understand where money and investment should go to best serve the people, but William pointed out three things of where it can grow is just generally to first help people to use evidence-based research to do so, and then to actually go out and do it. And so this question about reproducibility is one that we all need to think about when we're trying to understand what is the evidence that we're using to go help people. And so effective altruists rely heavily, and other people within the philanthropic community and the policymaking community rely heavily on evidence-based research to determine, what are the right interventions to do. And you may have heard, there's this reproducibility crisis, or there's talk of a reproducibility crisis. And it affects what we think about, because if you look at the top charities that GiveWell recommends to donate to and to support because of their effectiveness, you have many that have kind of come and been kind of questioned on the evidence that they use. And so you look at Deworm the World and a lot of the deworming organizations out there that are doing deworming. And then you kind of follow news stories, and you see there are a lot of news stories about questioning whether science and evidence can be considered accurate or reliable. You have studies saying that maybe cancer research cannot be reproduced, or psychology studies are not reproducible. And so it still calls into question the evidence that you're trying to use. A recent Nature survey last year asked scientists in the hard sciences whether or not that the science is facing a reproducibility crisis. And what came out was that a fair majority, almost 90% of scientists, thought there was either a crisis or some sort of crisis happening. And so what does this all mean? A lot of researchers have started to conduct replications and try to reproduce scientific research to make sure, the evidence that we're finding in these studies are reliable. In cancer research, in 2012, an organization, Amgen, conducted a review of 87 studies where they tried to reproduce the studies and were only able to reproduce 13% of the studies. In psychology, a similar exercise was done of 100 of the top lab studies in 2015, and they found that they were only able to reproduce 36% of the studies. And then a similar exercise was done last year in behavioral economics, in lab experiments, in behavioral economics, similar to the psych studies. And they were able to reproduce 67%, or it was between 60 to 70% of the studies were able to find similar findings. So what does this mean? Well, I wanted to kind of first, before I get into answering this question, what are the potential causes of this possible reproducibility crisis? I want to talk a little bit about my organization, who we are, and then get into what the causes are of the reproducibility crisis, why maybe it's not as big of an issue today than we think it is, and then what are different organizations, like my organization, the Poverty Action Lab, and other organizations, research organizations in the social science doing about it for research in the social sciences? And, you know, the truth is that we don't really know or have really strong evidence about the reproducibility crisis, whether it is a crisis or not. Those studies that I just showed you only look at a small number of studies and try to reproduce a small number of studies. Conducting replications is not easy, and it's really hard to do. And there are a lot of different types of replications that can be done. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit more detail. But my organization, the Poverty Action Lab, we have been around for 15 years. We conduct research on poverty alleviation, economic development across the world, and we've conducted more than 800 studies that are ongoing or completed around the world. We do this, our mission is to reduce poverty alleviation by ensuring or influencing policy decision-making using evidence-based research. And so we take our evaluations, we do policy outreach, and then we also work with policymakers and organizations that are implementing the interventions on understanding the research. And so we have three different teams: our research team, who conducts the evaluations. We have over 150 150 researchers worldwide who work for us, who work with us as a network. And then we have 200 research staff that work conducting the evaluations. We have our policy outreach team, who creates very close partnerships with implementing governments, both at the national and the state level, to really help them understand and work with the policymakers to build these interventions or this research into their policy decision-making process. And then we have the capacity building team, which trains the policymakers on kind of how to understand this type of research in RCTs. So kind of enough about kind of talking about what we do, getting into more of the potential causes of the reproducibility crisis, what may or may not lead to some of these causes. We have a few issues that come up often. And the first one that we have is the incentive system in academic research. Researchers themselves are incentivized to publish research in high value journals. And that's essentially the process of how they're going to potentially get tenure and make sure that their research is actually read. And so what happens is this leads to a highly competitive process. There are only so many journal articles that can be published in a top journal. And so you have a kind of structure where, you know, the norms of the incentive system, the incentive system creates these perverse norms. And there was an interesting study in 2008 that looked at, it was some sociologists that looked at where scientists and social science researchers understood the norms in their fields. And it asked three questions. So it first asked, do you subscribe or do you believe in these scientific norms that, these general scientific norms, and they went into a lot of detail about the norms, but these general scientific norms, you believe in them? And about 80 to 90% of the researchers said, yes, we believe in them. And then the second question asked, how often do you subscribe to these scientific norms in your own research when you're conducting research? And then the number sort of dropped to about 60, 70% of researchers said, yes, I fully subscribe to these scientific norms. And then it asked a third question, which was, do you feel others fully subscribe to these scientific norms. And you know, when you're doing kind of research on corruption or other types of sensitive questions, you might ask people what they think others do, because they're not going to say, I do this, I admit to doing this. Instead, they say, well, yeah, I think maybe my neighbors do this. Maybe they pay bribes to make sure things get done. So the study asks if, you know, academics thought other researchers in their field were, you know, fully subscribing to these norms. And it dropped pretty significantly down to about 20% of researchers who thought that was the case. And so this incentive structure then goes into a few of the other points that sort of lead to issues in reproducibility. And the next issue is generally the file drawer problem. So what we have with the file drawer problem is that researchers who are conducting research don't always publish the results of their study. And the reason why they're not going to publish the results of their study is potentially because they didn't have any results. So they know that they're not going to get published in a journal, so they don't actually submit it to a journal. And so the researchers then hold back, and no one knows whether or not the intervention that they were testing had positive results or negative or no results, and so it doesn't get published. A third issue that leads into the reproducibility crisis is publication bias. You mentioned that authors are only going to submit results when they think that they're going to be published. Well, that's partly because journals are only going to publish, or more often than not, publish positive results. And so, therefore, authors are incentivized to publish or to submit positive results. The final issue that I'm going to talk about with a potential problem that leads to the reproducibility crisis is p-hacking. And the way to understand p-hacking and the way social science research, primarily in economics, psychology's recently changed a little bit, but the way social science research and experimentation is done is using p-values to ensure that you have a p-values tell you whether that there's a potential, what is the chance that you might not have had positive results. So the standard in economics is 5%. If you get a result, you want to make sure that it's going to be accurate, or there's a 5% chance it might not be accurate. And so what this does with p-hacking is that it incentivizes people, what happens, and this has been shown, that people will play around with data, maybe drop some observations here, maybe add some more subjects to the population, to the study, and they try to play with the data to make sure they get down to 5% accuracy. To explain this better, John Oliver recently talked about p-hacking and scientific studies, and explained essentially what p-hacking is to a very late, to his audience. When I talk about 5%, why it's important, and what happens is that you can continue, and this has happened. This has been shown to happen in psychology. You can continue to test something and test something and test something and test something until you get a positive result, and then you can say, I'm going to take that positive result and write it up. And so what was happening in a lot of psychology experiments is that people would have lab space, and they would run a lab study, and they would run it and run it and run it, get a positive result, and then they wouldn't actually report when they wrote up the paper that they had run the experiment 5 or 6 times. And guess what? They reported that green jelly beans are linked to acne. So that's one of the issues we have with reproducibility. Then you have a study here that's potentially published, and are we to believe it or not? Now, getting into kind of what we think about when we're thinking about running a replication and trying to understand if the research is accurate if we're trying to replicate it, there's a lot of issues that we have to think about in terms of what we're replicating and what is reproducible. So at the very basic level, what we try to understand when we're trying to understand if a study is reproducible is the data and code that a researcher is publishing, can we even just rerun that data and code? You know, if there are some findings out there, we take the data and code. Are they available, first of all? Can we take it? Then, okay, let's look at the study. And let's look at the paper. And based on this, can we replicate the actual results that they said? So maybe they said, you know, green jelly beans are linked to acne. Well, maybe it's not an issue that they ran the study so many times, but maybe it's an issue that there was a coding error or something was wrong with the code. Can we take the data and code that was published and available and then actually run through the code and make sure it's accurate? And that's running kind of a reanalysis to some extent. Then we ask the question of, were the results of this study made by chance? So this is a question of how many times was the study run? Eventually, it could be the results could be positive by chance. The final question we would have is, does the study work in another context? And this is what the psych experiment that I mentioned earlier tried to do too, is run studies in a different context. And so this is where we're also trying to understand of what is reproducible or replicable around the world. And so here you're really testing the theory of the study. And so therefore it's become, you know, it's really hard to do that too. So I've once used an example that as I was driving in my car with some physicists, and I said, well, you know, in social sciences, you're testing something in one country and you try to test it in another context. It's a completely different context. It's not a laboratory. And so I used the example that, you know, it's not like gravity. With gravity, if you're here in the US and you test gravity and then you go over to Europe, you test gravity, it's pretty much the same. It's constant. And they quickly told me that that was wrong. But you have to understand the context of what you're working with in order to try to reproduce a study. So that psychology, the psychology lab experiment and the behavioral economics experiments where they took some of the studies, one of the studies they actually did was to try to replicate emotional investing behavior on emotional advice. And the treatment was to show, in the original study, the treatment was to show a video of Robin Williams being, you know, happy, and everyone, you know, thinks positive emotions with Robin Williams in some of his movies. And from the time the original study happened until the time that the replication was done, Robin Williams had committed suicide. And so the replicators had to think of, how can we test the theory of the original study and still try to get the same treatment, you know, still using the same treatment and intervention. And they ended up using it in a different country. The study ended up not replicating, even though they were using, you know, the replication team was actually working with the original research team to design the new replication study, and they couldn't replicate it. So sometimes moving to a different context is quite challenging and difficult. So that sort of describes the landscape of what we think of as the reproducibility crisis. So you know, the question is, where are we headed? And it's ironically, the presentation before was talking about nuclear war. I really didn't know that he was talking about that. And we're not actually headed to nuclear war or nuclear winter. Instead, you know, I think that, you know, I think the way we need to think about it is that science is an extremely, you know, it takes a long time. It's a process that works with the accumulation of knowledge. And we shouldn't just jump on one particular study and say, here's the evidence on this. At JPL, we've been around for 15 years, and we've conducted over 800 studies. There's only so many studies that we say, or so many interventions where we have enough evidence to say that this is the correct course of action and that this is the policy advice we're going to provide based on the evidence we have. And so therefore, we're very careful about when we say we do have evidence, and there's overwhelming evidence on a particular study. Now, there's also an issue, it's not as big of an issue. We see some evidence, too, that this reproducibility crisis, particularly with the idea of p-hacking, is not as big of an issue in randomized control trials in economics. So what this chart shows you here is kind of a little hump here where the p-value of a study, where the significance level is at 5% or 0.05. And this shows you that, you know, there are a lot of studies in if there were no case of p-hacking or publication bias, what we would see is just a normal distribution here. But instead, we have a large hump indicating that there are a lot of studies being published. This is a graph of all the p-values that are published in economics from 2012 to 2015 in experimental studies. And so then when we look at this chart here on the left, you know, we look at randomized control trials versus laboratory experiments versus other sources of data versus different journals. We see that there's not a dip in randomized control trials or hump in randomized control trials. And there's a lot less potential for p-hacking. And part of the reason for this is that randomized control trials are much, much harder to run. And they take much longer period of time. The planning process goes into, you have to understand, develop the power calculations and the sample size. And they take a while to run. And so, it doesn't, the case does not become as big of an issue. So where do we go from here? And part of it is that, you know, we're seeing that transparent practices are leading to better research and better kind of solidification of the evidence to understand what is actually happening. So some of you may be familiar with both of these studies. I don't want to get into the details too much, but both of them were a case where actually the authors of the studies were very open and very transparent about their data. One of them, with the same-sex marriage in California, found that the data, subsequent researchers who were trying to replicate the study found that the original data was fraudulent, based on not being able to replicate the results of the original study, and then they started to question things. Second study went through a replication process, and I think that the original evidence has come out stronger in the end. And so, therefore, you know, it's been these replication processes and publishing of data and code. So there have been a lot of changes in the communities in social science research over the last couple of years, particularly in psychology, where they published in 2014 this article where they outlined all changes in psych science, the top journal in psychology, where, you know, people had to report certain things. There would be no more limits to the methods section. They had to say whether or not they had ran this experiment multiple different times previously. And they started to just require more openness about the reporting mechanism. There's also been an effort, a cross-disciplinary effort in psychology and led by the Center for Open Science, a transparency promotion group, to get journals on board and donors on board with increasing their practices. So journals committing to requiring data and code to be published and other materials and requiring some of the very basic requirements that psychology allowed. Then there's been a lot of registries. So the first registry that started was clinicaltrials.gov, and this was where all, you know, clinical trials need to register and pre-register their studies. This has really started to take shape in other fields as well. So in economics, there's the AEA Social Science Registry. There's also the Open Science Framework, where you can just register your study and you register all of the materials related to your study, including kind of even emails and decision-making processes. There's a registry in political science. There's a registry just for international development, for education research. And then you can, you know, pre-register your studies here in a pre-registration website called As Predicted. So there are a lot of different areas where this can be registered. And, you know, the growth has been pretty astounding. In the 4 years since the AEA has had their registry, there have been over 1,200 studies now registered, and it just continues to climb. So, you know, another area of it's not just pre-registration, but it's publishing the data in code, making sure the data in code is accurate. So, therefore, researchers who want to go in and understand the data, and all this is happening now, and this is what J-PAL is working on too. You know, we've been working on building the data repository within the Dataverse for J-PAL studies and J-PAL researchers, and really changing the landscape in development economics research to ensure that data and code are published and they're reliable, and anyone can go in and try to reproduce the data and code. Another really innovative thing that we're trying is a lot of the replications that occur in science and social science today are done after the study is published. And after the study is published, the original researchers have a strong incentive to say, my research has been my original research results were accurate, you know, they're correct. Nobody wants to retract an article. So what we've done is started these fellowships where we're going to try to conduct replications before the study's published and working with our affiliated researchers to ensure that the study results there can be replicated in advance to publishing, and it reduces that sort of natural tension between the replication team and the original researchers. And then the original researchers have time to update their results or change their study or maybe not submit their study to a journal. And then we're building online resources to work with different organizations. So there's a lot of different things going on. The Center for Open Sciences has badges that they give out for transparent processes in psychology. And then another group, the Berkeley Initiative for Transparency in Social Sciences, does a lot of training, and they've got online materials. They've also given out prizes. They're trying to change the incentive structure for researchers. So, final thoughts. I want to end. I know, so we have time for Q&A, and I'm holding everyone from lunch. You know, scientific knowledge takes time. It's a long process of the accumulation of knowledge. When we think about evidence-based research, we shouldn't think about just what does this one study say, and is that's the be-all, end-all on the evidence. We need to see about the accumulation of knowledge and the accumulation of evidence. And, you know, transparent practices that are now really, you know, these things that I'm talking about are not on the cusp anymore. They're being solidified in the social sciences. They're happening, and they're becoming regular practices. You know, they're leading to better research, certainly, and they're leading to better research outcomes. So, thank you again for listening. My name's James Torito. I'm going to be around for office hours if people want after lunch, 2 o'clock. I'll be here from 2 to 2:30, and I'll also be around during lunch. Yeah.
Let's have a seat. We've got a few minutes for Q&A, and those office hours are going to be in room 110. So a couple of questions off the bat from the audience. One, do you have a sense for kind of what your own, or maybe Jay, I don't know if this is something you could speak on behalf of the organization or just yourself, but what a kind of vision for the future would be? Is there a single standard? You know, somebody proposes all studies just need to be pre-registered, and it's just that just has to be the rule. And if you don't do it, you know, you can't be published. Do we want to be that stringent? Is it sort of more context specific in terms of what the standards should be? Like, what do you think we should be aiming for?
So, you know, I think that's the way it is in clinical trials, is that if you are not pre-registered, you can't get published in a medical journal. I don't know that we're going to ever get there in social sciences, or if that's kind of the way to go. I do think, you know, that registering the studies in advance is important, and whether or not you're going to get journals on board, because all of the journals kind of have their own opinions about how they want to go through the publishing process, don't necessarily do that. But I do think, you know, journals can do something about really publishing data in code. So this doesn't get to the issue of publication bias and making sure every study is registered in advance, but you know, I think it gets to whether or not we can reproduce studies that are being published. And so making sure that the proper data and code are published, and they're published with every study, and they're accessible with the original articles. A lot of times journals have data publication policies and replication policies, but then they don't necessarily have the data available. The American Economics Association actually does this. They publish it right on the website, right with on the same page of the study. They actually have the data and code there, and I think that's, you know, I think that's something a lot more journals need to be able to do.
Is that, do you think that contributes to the, I was surprised on one of your slides you showed kind of three different domains and the reproducibility rate. I would have probably guessed that they would have been reversed relative to what they actually were. I believe economics was on top, behavioral economics at least, was kind of on top of those three. Do you think that is like a downstream consequence of standards that people have put in place? Is that like, is that the result of a change, or is that just kind of the baseline for the field?
I think it could be, but I think that when you talk about cancer trials and cancer research, there are a lot of private companies that are involved with that type of research. And in psychology and in economics, it's primarily academics. And honestly, we don't know what the actual rate of reproducibility should be. If we're talking about reanalyzing a study using the original data and code, we should be able to get the same results that the authors published, right? Like, that should be 100%. If we're talking about trying to reproduce a study that in a different context, I think it's really challenging to do. I mean, you have to really understand the context that the study was done. And in lab studies, you know, you should be able to have the same context, but then you have cases, you know, where, you know, the study was changed and you're really testing the theory all along the process.
This question puts me out on a limb a little bit because I don't know much about it, but from the audience, researcher Ben Olkin, I believe a colleague of yours, published an article called The Promises and Perils of Pre-Analysis Plans, in which he has some criticisms of the pre-analysis idea. Could you maybe summarize those for us to the degree that you know them and respond to them? Do you think they're valid? You know, what would you add to that discussion?
Sure. So Ben Olkin is the director of JPL, and so effectively my boss, so I don't want to criticize him too much. But I honestly, to summarize what he means by it, I can talk about that a little bit and want to, and I'm sure he would probably say that I'm not summarizing him well enough. But no, he, you know, I think his paper comes off as being, you know, people think that he's completely criticizing pre-analysis plans and thinks they shouldn't be done. And that's not the reality, is that he does believe that there's a value to pre-analysis plans in certain situations. So the value to pre-analysis plans is, on a few occasions, you know, sometimes when you're working with an implementing partner, you know, the types of interventions we're doing, we're always working with partners who are in the field. And whether it's a government, whether it's an organization that's implementing the intervention, they have particular interest in seeing the program or intervention be successful. And so they want to see certain results potentially from the studies, or, you know, they really want to know what they're doing. And so what's nice for a pre-analysis plan for researchers is it's almost like an agreement, or I wouldn't say a contract, but it's an agreement before the research gets done about what is going to be done and that the results will be published and what are they actually testing. And so that's one of the things that he finds to be really valuable about pre-analysis plans. In addition, another thing that's valuable is that they're able to increase the power in some cases, particularly when you're trying to do some sort of subgroup analysis. And so for pre-analysis plans, so I probably should have gone into this to begin with, pre-analysis plans are just kind of outlining up front what the type of study you're going to run and what type of analysis you're going to do. And so his kind of, what he says about pre-analysis plans is that it's really hard in some types of study to do it, because you may have several different hypotheses in a study that all build on the previous hypothesis. And in order to have several, in order to write out all of the potential possibilities of how you're going to analyze that third or fourth or fifth hypothesis that's based on, you know, the previous hypotheses, you're going to have to then really write out many different plans for analyses. And so it becomes untenable for...
kind of a tree structure of...
Exactly, yeah.
Garden of forking paths of your own analysis.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Max Tegmark in the previous talk talked a little bit about using stigmatization to change the way that people think about nuclear weapons. It seems that there's, especially when you see it on John Oliver, it seems like there's sort of a cultural shift underway. Do you think this is primarily a cultural shift? And what can people do as maybe a member of the EEA movement who are not necessarily doing their own studies to sort of apply the kind of, you know, vague or diffuse, but nevertheless seemingly very important social pressure that this issue needs to kind of ensure that people get on board over time?
Sure. Yeah, I think there is a cultural shift slowly. I mean, it's you know, just looking at that chart I showed about registrations and economics, it's gone from, you know, zero in 2013 when we first started the registry to now 1,200. And, you know, the rate of registered studies just continues to grow every year. And so that's exciting to see. And there's a lot of other, you know, there's a lot of attempts to do things within the transparency, people who are promoting transparency and transparent research practices. And then there's a lot more that are starting to stick. And so, one of the things that can be done is, I think in terms of the EA movement is to really think more about think about the research you're reading. If you are, you know, trying to make decisions or trying to look at evidence-based approaches, you should just, you know, look at the studies that you're actually basing those decisions on, and not just necessarily read the headlines, or stick with a trusted organization that you know understands the research and does dig into the research. Because a lot of times you see research, you know, in headlines that is based on kind of, you know, shoddy research. Maybe they only use 20 or 30, a sample size of 20 or 30 people in a laboratory of undergraduate college students with a certain social economic status, or maybe they're saying something about nutrition that is based on using mice in a laboratory, and they're then, you know, applying it to human nutrition. So, you know, there's another slide that I wanted to, John Oliver's bit on this is actually great, if people haven't seen it. But there's another thing he talks about, which is that, you know, donors need to help fund replications. And getting to that cultural shift, there is no incentive to do replications for researchers. Unfortunately, the incentive is to, if you're doing a replication, the incentive is to overturn the original results, not confirm them. And so those researchers are going to do it. If they want to try to get published, they have to try to overturn them. And so generally, you know, if donors can fund more research replications and replications became more common, and then journals could publish replications more often. I mean, I think that's something that people are looking for to help sort of resolve this debate of whether there's a reproducibility crisis.
James Cerrito, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Office hours at 2 p.m. in room 110. Right now we've got lunch. You can find it right out the main front entrance to the Science Center. It'll be in a tent on the lawn. So just right out the door here, out the front main entrance, and there's your lunch. Thank you very much. We'll see you back here at 2 o'clock.